composing wasn't something I... In other words, I always felt there was something I had to vault over in order to compose. And what that was this clunky sense of me composing. And it's... I'm sure it's something that anyone who tries to create something can appreciate, because you always want to lose yourself in the medium so that you can forget it and really write something and communicate something.
That was Peter Lieberson, perhaps Nova Scotia's newest classical composer. This is Rock Meets Bone. I'm Brian Guns. Before moving to Halifax from Boston with his wife and three daughters last year, composer Peter Lieberson was professor of music at Harvard University. His music first came to international attention in 1983 when his piano concerto was premiered by pianist Peter Serkin with the Boston Symphony Orchestra conducted by Seiji Ozawa. Ozawa immediately commissioned him again to write a symphony, which Lieberson titled Drala. He is presently at work on commissions from the San Francisco Symphony and the New York Philharmonic. Also, the City of Munich asked him to compose an hour-long theater piece involving performers Peter Serkin, Emmanuel Ax, and Yo-Yo Ma. Peter is currently Executive Director of Shambhala Training International, a meditation program founded by the late Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Recently, Sam Burkholz spoke with composer Peter Lieberson in Halifax.
What brings you to Nova Scotia, and how does it affect your music?
Well, I came to Nova Scotia a year ago with my family, and I moved here from Boston after teaching for a number of years at Harvard University. And I came here as long ago as 1981, I think it was, when I came to teach a program called Shambhala Training. And I've been visiting more or less every year or every other year since then. And when I was offered the position of directing Shambhala Training International, of which I'm now the executive director, I leapt at it because it was very close to my heart, and I felt it was a wonderful opportunity to move my family up here, because I wanted my girls, my three girls, to grow up in a harmonious community. And I find in many ways that the place has affected me. I'm very sensitive to the seasons and to the atmosphere of Nova Scotia. I've traveled around a bit, and I find that it's affected my musical thinking in some ways. I'm planning a piece for the San Francisco Symphony, and I expect that I will write it about the seasons, in some sense, the seasonal changes that I've experienced here.
Now that you're here in Nova Scotia, is there anything about your music that has a Nova Scotian flavor, or is there anything in the way that you compose your music that takes on the flavor of the place that you're living?
I don't think it's really that one-to-one. I think that basically a composer composes from his or her sense of their body and their body rhythm. It's somewhat like a dancer. And I think that that affects you no matter where you live. I feel particularly sensitive to the wind here, for example, the way it shifts and the way it might rain 5 minutes and then it'll be sunny, then it might snow, or then it might be suddenly cold, whereas it started off very warm. And I find that I'm very alive to that, and very keen on the vividness of the colors here. That's one of the first things I noticed when I first moved here, was how vivid everything was. For example, in Boston, even in the summer, on the fall, when you'd expect there to be a vivid, vivid blue sky, there's a haze that pervades everything. And here, there's nothing. It's very clear. It's very direct. And I'm very impressed by that, and it's affected me.
When you sit down to compose, what happens?
Well, usually there's a sense that you don't know what you're doing. And there's a sense of blank space, blankness. And also a sense of impulse. That your body, I think composers probably are very tuned into their bodily rhythms, even though the legends wouldn't hold up to that. The usual sense of composers that they really can't tie their own shoes, or they forget to wash their face or brush their teeth in the morning. But there is a sense of listening to the impulses that take place within your body. And for me, I don't think I could purposefully change the way in which my music comes out. But you also have to develop a receptivity to that. And so I think that there are certain attitudes that I've learned over the years. I've been composing for 25 years, that you could have a sense of waiting. And while you're waiting, things begin to percolate. And then if you're there, you begin to catch those events, those things. And they aren't necessarily notes. I don't think that I really hear melodies per se, although I could if I wanted to, I suspect. But it's more a sense of tuning into atmosphere.
So are there any principles that you sort of work with in composing your music that come out of this rhythm?
Yes. Basically, I compose, or I have composed pieces according to a very simple principle called heaven, earth, and man. And it might sound somewhat foreign because the words have many different kinds of meaning. Heaven has a lot of meaning to us. Man seems to represent only one person as opposed to man and woman. And earth is something we take very much for granted. But actually, the three things are principles which we could think about. And in a certain sense, what I've been describing when you ask me how I compose, heaven is that sense of uncertainty or just waiting and being patient. Then something begins to take place. And in a way, what you have to be is the earth. You have to be grounded and just waiting. You have to be willing to be patient and wait. Then some impulse begins to occur. And that, in a way, is the man principle. Something, some gesture, some desire to communicate. And then the whole thing joins together, and you basically put the marks down on the paper. Thank you.
When you were writing your piano concerto, is there anything particular that you had in mind to communicate? Or did the concerto just arrive, so to speak?
Well, there are a lot of factors with the piano concerto. First of all, it was my first really major commission. I was 33, and I've been waiting for a long time to write an orchestral piece. Up until that point, I'd had a reasonable amount of success. I mean, I'd had the usual grants and performances, and Pierre Boulez did my music at New York Philharmonic and so on. But I had never been asked to write an orchestral piece. And this was something that I had been longing to do for a very long time. And Peter Serkin, who's a very good friend of mine, sent my scores to Seiji Ozawa, who was the conductor of the Boston Symphony. And I think really on the basis of Peter's recommendation, he paid attention to them, because they weren't much. They were these very pointillistic and scratchy kinds of scores, and very 60s, you know, 12-tone music kind of thing. And but Seiji listened and listened and listened, and finally he came around and he said he liked it. So I was sort of the unknown quantity out of 12 composers. All the others were quite well known, and I was sort of the young Turk. And this was the centennial commissions that the Boston Symphony did. So this was a very big deal for me. And then I also used these notions that we were discussing earlier about heaven, earth, and man. And I found that that one of the wonderful things about being a composer, and I think it probably applies to other artists as well, is that you can find out about yourself and about things that you want to explore through the medium of the art form. In other words, instead of making a mess in the world by finding out about things, which you can do, it's perfectly fine, but you can also explore in your own medium. So I wanted to find out in this case about these principles, heaven, earth, and man. What does that really mean? What does heaven mean in the sense of spaciousness or uncertainty or tremendous room for things to take place? Or the man principle, which is a sense of heart or communicativeness, or earth, which is solid and which is unyielding. So I thought, well, I'll start with earth. And so I began to write a piece that way. And then it began to come along. And interestingly enough, I wrote that movement, I remember very well, I wrote it in the basement of my house because that's where my studio was. I have three children and they were very young and running around and screaming a lot, and this was the only place I could get away. The second movement was based on the man principle. So I found myself, really not thinking about it, I found myself on the second floor of my house looking out of the window. And there I didn't even work at the piano. I didn't compose at the piano. I just did it in my head, which baffles me in a way because I really don't know how I did it. And then that was done. And then the third movement was heaven, which is going somewhat backwards, but in a way it's more path-oriented, journey-oriented, because I didn't know all that much about heaven. Who does, after all? And I found myself at a library at the university I was attending. I was getting a PhD at the time, which had an enormous floor-to-ceiling window, but, I mean, many, many feet high, which looked out over this expanse. And I wrote the entire movement there. Now, this is you might think this is so literal. How could somebody actually be so corny? But I really didn't plan it that way. It just happened. Mm-hmm. So that's about as literal as it's ever been. And then with later pieces, of course, it became a little more internalized.
Here are the opening bars of Peter Lieberson's Piano Concerto. Seiji Ozawa conducts the Boston Symphony with Peter Serkin, pianist.
bagatelles were much more simple because they were less ambitious. And I wrote them for Peter Serkin. And we'd worked together on this entire piano concerto, which is a 45-minute piece, so I knew him very well as a performer. And it was very simple to write. I just, in fact, these are adaptations of a piece that I wrote for another group, but I found it worked better as a piece for Peter Serkin. So again, these bagatelles are very straightforward. They're, one is a kind of, the first one is a proclamation, just a very simple statement. And then the second one are a whole series of little songs. They're called spontaneous songs, but they're very much like a kind of Schumann piece, very short, concise lyrics. And then the third one is a waltz. And so it was very simple and very easy, free-flowing to write. I wrote the waltz in 2 days.
That was Peter Serkin playing Peter Lieberson's third bagatelle, The Dance.
And then for the other piece that we might play today, which is called Drala, this was the second commission that I received from the Boston Symphony. In fact, right after the premiere of the piano concerto, Seiji Ozawa took me to a restaurant, took my wife and myself, and we were sitting around with Peter Serkin and his wife, and he said, next time, I want you to write a shorter piece, because that was a joke, because I was supposed to write a 20-minute piano concerto, it came out to be 45 minutes. And I was reminded that I wasn't asked to write an opera. So I said that I would, and along came this piece called Drala.
Peter, what does Drala mean?
Well, Drala means quite a few things, but principally it goes back to the whole discussion we had about atmosphere. Drala, dra means enemy, la means above, so it means above enemy, but it means a great deal more than that, because it isn't simply something that is, what it means to be above enemy is to be without aggression. And that doesn't mean to be without strength or power, but it simply means to be without a grudge. And I think everyone has experienced this very simply, that when you aren't preoccupied with something, when you don't have a grudge, and you go out into the, let's say, into nature, into the country, and you look at mountains or sea or experience the rain or particularly the wind, let's say, or the shifts of mood that takes place in the weather, then you experience the sense of magic and atmosphere that we could call Drala. And that atmosphere and magic can become so real that it's almost an entity. You could almost see it. But at the same time, it's not separate from the phenomena. In other words, the wind isn't, there isn't a person who is the wind. It is simply the wind. But the wind itself could be experienced so powerfully that it is Drala. It's almost an entity. It has a sense of magical quality to it.
Is this like the Norse gods?
Yes, as a matter of fact, yes. In fact, I think every culture has their Drala, so to speak, and they personify them. The Norwegians were, I remember when I was about 19, I went back to Norway. I'd spent a lot of time when I was a kid, about 6, 7, 8 years old, like that. And when I was 19, I went back to Norway and I camped out on a mountain, very high up, and I had this sense that a troll could easily peer over the mountain anytime. And I felt this was the sense of somebody portraying the idea of Drala, because it's almost, there's something so inhabited and so vivid about the mountains and the sky and the stars and the wind and the smell that it almost has a face. And that face in Norway was a troll.
And what's that face here in Nova Scotia?
I haven't met them yet.
Oh, I see.
I mean, I don't know. I've only been here a year. It would be presumptuous of me.
But would you like to meet them?
Yes, very much. I probably have, but I haven't been introduced, I suppose.
Seiji Ozawa conducts the Boston Symphony Orchestra with the opening section of Peter Lieberson's Drala. Thank you.
since 1981 I've been coming here, and I have begun to find out why it is such a wonderful place. And it is not a wonderful place because it's so warm or so easygoing, particularly, but it's a wonderful place because it's so real, and the atmosphere is real, and the people are real, and the people are wonderful, and I enjoy living here, even though it's not all that comfortable, and the weather's not all that wonderful. But I like it here, and that's why I moved here. And I found that I'm much more joyful here than I was teaching at Harvard University. So explain that.
We'd like to thank Peter Lieberson for his music and reflections, and Sam Burkholz for his interviewing. Rock Meets Bone is produced with the assistance of the Naropa Institute of Canada. Thanks for listening.